From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. For his debut novel, The Kite Runner, Khaled Hosseini wanted to recapture the Afghanistan of his childhood before the Soviet invasion, the Taliban, and Osama bin Laden. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Hosseini. His novel has become a surprise success. It's been on the paperback bestseller list for nearly 50 weeks and has been on many book club reading lists. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Incendiary, the debut novel by British writer Chris Cleave, and rock historian Ed Ward profiles arranger and producer Jack Nitzsche, who worked with Phil Spector and many others. A new CD collects his work. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The novel The Kite Runner has become something of a publishing phenomenon. It's been on the New York Times paperback bestseller list for nearly 50 weeks, but it doesn't fit in the genres of romance, crime, espionage, or conspiracy. Plus, it's a debut novel. The author is my guest, Khaled Hosseini. The Kite Runner is inspired by his own experiences. He grew up in Afghanistan just before the Soviet invasion. His father was a diplomat. In fact, in 1979, at the time of the Soviet invasion, Hosseini's father was working at the Afghan embassy in Paris. The family requested and received political asylum in the U.S. They moved to San Jose, California in 1980, where Hosseini still lives. Although it was his dream to become a writer, he became a physician. He's still practicing internal medicine, although he's now on leave, working on his second novel. Khaled Hosseini, welcome to Fresh Air. When did you realize that The Kite Runner was actually selling?
I think around the time, just before the paperback was released in April of 2004, and the hardback was kind of towards its tail end, and it was beginning to appear in bestseller lists, which is very unusual after a year of being out in the market. It was just appearing. So it was really just a slow, simmering thing, and I really think there's no better PR than word of mouth. And so it came out of the gates in a kind of a pedestrian way. But the word of mouth really, really built and it spread. And by the time the hardback was off the shelves and the paperback was coming in, I think that word of mouth was really beginning to swell. And then a whole number of communities picked this book for their regional yearly read. And that really kind of added fuel to that fire, and then it just really took off from there.
Now, I've seen people reading The Kite Runner on planes, and I figure you've seen people reading your book on planes. And it got me thinking, like, I bet when you're on a plane that some people are doing the whole, uh-oh, is he a terrorist? And at the same time, some people are reading your book. do you go through like both extremes when you're flying?
I've never experienced the first one, but I was on a flight and I was sitting next to a lady who was reading the book and kind of surreptitiously crying, and she would like dab at her eyes with a napkin now and then, and I was somewhat tempted to tell her who I was, but then I figured there would be this whole, she was reading the paperback and there was no author photo, and she would ask, how do I know it's you? And I would have to quote some line or, God forbid, show an ID. Yeah, I mean, the embarrassing logistics of it always kind of overshadows the romanticism of it for me.
Well, the main character in The Kite Runner is the son of a wealthy businessman in Kabul, and he grows up best friends with the son of one of the family's servants. Now, they're of different ethnic groups, and one is Sunni and one is Shia Muslim. Who is, I assume the main character is very loosely based on your life. What about his friend? Who was that based on?
Well, I had a similar socioeconomic kind of background and upbringing to the main character, Amir. And like him, there were, in his household, there were always people working in around my house. And I had a friendship with one of them, a man much older than myself. He was probably in his 30s. And he was an ethnic Hazara, like the character of Hassan. And he was a cook. And I struck up a friendship with him. And we became close. And he was kind of my partner in flying kites. And he would take me out to the movies and play in the park with me and so on. I remember him as a very affable, kind, gentleman, and almost angelic in a certain way, which I'm sure influenced the writing of this character of Hassan, who in his own way is very kind of angelic. So I loosely based Hassan on this man that I knew from my own childhood.
And I believe you taught him how to read.
Yeah, he was. He was illiterate, and in fact, his whole, he told me no one in his family had ever gone to school. He was from a very rugged mountainous area in central Afghanistan, where there really wasn't much in way of institutions. And so he was illiterate, and at the time I was in about third grade, and in the course of our friendship, one thing led to another, and I kind of became his impromptu teacher and taught him the alphabet, and he took it from there, and I would assign him homework, and he would practice reading and writing. And by the time he left the household, he was reading children's books and beginning to read the newspaper very slowly. So, and that's something that sort of made its way into the novel as well.
You grew up in Afghanistan before the Soviet invasion, and of course before the Taliban came to power. What did you want to capture in your novel about what life was like in Afghanistan before the Soviet invasion?
Well, you know, for so long, and maybe justifiably so, Afghanistan's been totally synonymous with the Soviet war or, you know, the opium trade or the Taliban or bin Laden. But the fact was there was an Afghanistan before all of those things. And in fact, that's the only Afghanistan I know that I remember from my childhood, having grown up in the 1970s before the communist coup. So I kind of wanted to recreate that lost time and era in at least the first third of this book, and to kind of bring life a sweeter, more innocent Kabul that I remember from my childhood, and to remind the reader that Afghanistan wasn't always about the caves of Tora Bora and bombings and landmines and so on, that there was a better time in that country's history, and not that long ago. It just seems a very long time ago. So I wanted to recreate the Afghanistan of my own childhood, which I remember with a great deal of fondness.
What's one of your fondest memories about your neighborhood?
Well, I mean, you say Kabul to me, and I think kites. And it's not surprising. It's before any of the characters, the kites came first when I wrote this book, and so maybe my fondest memories revolve around the winter. Winters in Kabul when schools were out, and we had these 3 months of freedom to run around and cause trouble with my cousins and my brothers, and inevitably a kite tournament would break out, and we would build our kites and buy our glass strings and fly kites all day. So that's almost by word association what I think of when I think of those years.
My guest is Khaled Hosseini, and he is the author of the bestseller, The Kite Runner. You left Kabul when you were 11. Your father was a diplomat, and he was sent to the Afghanistan embassy in France. What was his position in the embassy?
Well, he was two positions below the ambassador. There were three secretaries working at the embassy, and he was secretary number two. So he was working as basically an attaché, a diplomat in the embassy.
So you were in Paris when you heard that the Soviets had invaded Afghanistan?
Yeah, we were home having dinner, and there was a news break, and I saw on the television, we saw pictures of these Soviet tanks kind of rolling in, And I remember thinking with a very sinking feeling that we would never see Afghanistan again. And it was shortly after that my father began kind of covertly making preparations to move the family to the States.
This may be obvious, but what were some of the reasons why your parents would not consider bringing the family back to Afghanistan?
Well, there were mass executions going on at the time, and anybody affiliated with the previous regime was in danger. I said my father was the second secretary. The third secretary, who had become friends with the family, he ended up going back during the communist years, and he took his family back to Kabul. And unfortunately, shortly after that, we heard that he had been executed. So that was a very loud and clear message.
Did you have other friends or family who were executed or imprisoned during the Soviet era?
Oh, it would be hard to find an Afghan who hasn't. I had two of my cousins fled Kabul after their father was shot and killed at a traffic stop in Kabul. And the two brothers went to join their family in Pakistan, and they climbed the back of an empty fuel truck, and went from Kabul to Peshawar. And when the truck arrived in Peshawar, everybody climbed out, but the younger brother wouldn't wake up, and he had died in his sleep. There were other acquaintances that we know who were imprisoned, who were killed, too many to name maybe, but as I said, it would be really hard to speak to an Afghan who doesn't know of somebody who was harmed or killed or imprisoned in some way.
At what point did it register on you that you really couldn't go home again?
When my father revealed to us shortly before we came to the States that he had applied for political asylum and that we were going to go to a place called San Jose in California. He said it was on the west coast of the U.S. and that we weren't to tell anybody about this, that it would have to be a secret within the family, and within days we were gone. And it felt permanent. It felt like we weren't just moving, but rather relocating and really planning on starting a new life.
How did your parents choose San Jose?
They had a sponsor who was a lovely Afghan woman who lived in San Jose, and she was kind enough to sponsor us. And there was already in Northern California, here in the South Bay and a little bit in the East Bay, a kind of a budding Afghan community. People who were fleeing the Soviet war and coming to settle in the States. So there were already a few Afghan families here, and so that was attractive.
So your father got asylum in the United States for your family, but when you moved here, your family went from privilege. Your father had been a diplomat from Afghanistan. Your family went from privilege to basically to welfare. How did your parents handle that change in status?
I think, in retrospect, very gracefully. There wasn't much in the way of woebegone expressions and lamenting and that sort of thing. I think they were blessed with a really good sense of perspective that, as far as Afghans went, they were in a pretty good situation in California and safe. The being on welfare part of it was very hard on them, particularly on my dad. Both of my parents had always been sort of on the giving end of charity, and for them to live with the notion of being on the receiving end of it was a very hard blow to their pride. And so we didn't stay on welfare very long, just a couple of months, and my father volunteered us out and began working a number of jobs, as did my mother.
Didn't he eventually end up working for welfare?
Yeah, he first became a driving instructor, and so to this day he is the most reliable direction giver that I know. But he, in an ironic twist, he eventually found a job as a social worker with the city of Santa Clara, and now he's actually dispensing welfare to immigrant families.
My guest is Khaled Hosseini, author of the best-selling novel The Kite Runner. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Khaled Hosseini, author of the best-selling novel The Kite Runner, which is inspired by his own experiences growing up in Afghanistan before the Soviet invasion. We talked a little bit about what it was like for your family when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. What about when the Taliban came to power? Did you realize at first what an extremist regime it would be?
Well, not at first. I think initially everybody was relieved that the war was over. And by the war, I mean the horrible infighting between the various Mujahideen factions between 92 and 96, which did what the Soviets didn't do, that is, destroy Kabul completely. And so there was a sense of relief that finally there was stability. But it was very short-lived because stories began to leak out and people began to talk about what the Taliban were doing in Afghanistan. And so what relief there was to be enjoyed from the end of the war was quickly overshadowed by the knowledge of what the Taliban were imposing on the people.
Do you have any old friends who actually became members of the Taliban?
No, God, no. You know, most of the Taliban, I mean, I'm 40 now, and most of the Taliban were young boys during the Soviet war, and they were often boys who were fatherless and had to kind of languish in refugee camps in Pakistan and were put in these madrasas and were taught this very harsh brand of Islam. So it's a different generation. I think most of them tend to be were younger men.
What was the fate of your remaining friends and family in Afghanistan under the Taliban?
I have only one relative, direct relative, living in Kabul under the Taliban, and she has lived in the same house for about 40 years, and she's a very resolute, resilient woman who refuses to be moved from where she is, and she just bears it. She has found a rather unique way of dealing with everything, and she's essentially shut herself out of the reality of what's going on around her and has surrounded herself with a buffer of friends and relatives who help her and tend to her. I have a cousin in the western part of the country, in Herat, where the Taliban presence was very significant, but perhaps not quite as harsh as it was in Kabul.
I imagine that when you came to the United States, that your friends who weren't Afghans knew very little about Afghanistan, but that probably changed after September 11th, and certainly after the United States started bombing Afghanistan in an attempt to drive out the Taliban and capture bin Laden. What was it like for you when suddenly your country was in the news and people who wouldn't be able to find it on the map suddenly had a position on your country?
Yeah, it was bizarre that suddenly everybody was interested in Afghanistan, and they were talking about Mazar-e-Sharif and Qunduz and these towns that of course I knew about, but suddenly they were headlines on newspapers and television. It was very, very disorienting. And I experienced September 11th and the aftermath of it in two distinct ways. One, as somebody who's lived in America, who had lived in America for more than 20 years, so the sense of outrage and shock at the atrocity of it was registered with me as with any other American. But I also experienced it as an Afghan, especially when it became evident that the regime in Afghanistan had a hand in protecting the folks who would cause this problem. And so I felt, very ambivalent about what was going to happen in Afghanistan. On the one hand, here was an opportunity for this very brutal regime to end, but it also meant more bombing and more killing and the loss of more innocent lives. So it was very difficult and kind of a tumultuous time for us.
You returned to Afghanistan in 2003 for the first time since the Soviet invasion. So you left Afghanistan when you were 11. You returned in 2003 when you were 38. Was there anything left that you actually recognized?
Yeah, I had a very surprisingly vivid recollection of the layout of the city and where the different neighborhoods were, and there were landmarks that I recognized immediately. Some of the apartment complexes that I remembered, the old cinema where my brother and I used to go and watch westerns, the park where we used to fly kites, all of that was still there, albeit in a very neglected at best, demolished at worst kind of state. I visited my the aunt that I told you about, and she was in the same house, and I hadn't seen her in almost 30 years. So there were things that I recognized, but everything was altered in a terrible way. And the first two or three days that I was there, the destruction, how destitute people had become, it was very appalling. And I didn't think I would be able to last 2 weeks. And it takes a good two or three days to just kind of take a deep breath and be able to move forward.
How long did you last?
I was there the full 2 weeks. I was there with my brother-in-law, and here's a sad fact. After a few days, it registers in a different way. It's just life. It's just the way of life. The beggars, the widows, the amputees, all the people who've been scarred and damaged horribly by the war. It becomes part of life there. Not the background, but it just, you're not as appalled, as startled as you were the first few times. And it's just, I think, it's not a callous thing. It's just, it goes to show you how ubiquitous those things are in Kabul, and how there's no way of going anywhere without being confronted by what has happened there.
Khaled Hosseini is the author of the best-selling novel, The Kite Runner. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor audio courses, including masterpieces of Western music, classics from the Baroque to the modern. Additional support for NPR comes from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Ed Ward profiles arranger and producer Jack Nitzsche, who worked with Phil Spector, Bobby Darin, Little Stevie Wonder, Neil Young, and Marianne Faithfull. Maureen Corrigan reviews Incendiary, a new British novel set after a terrorist attack. And we continue our interview with Khaled Hosseini. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Khaled Hosseini, author of the best-selling novel The Kite Runner. It's inspired by his own experiences. He grew up in Afghanistan before the Soviet invasion. In 1979, at the time of the invasion, he was living in Paris, where his father was a diplomat at the Afghan embassy. The family received political asylum in the U.S. and moved to San Jose in 1980, where Hosseini still lives. Another thing about your novel, a lot of the story is really propelled by guilt. And I won't give away what it is that makes this character so guilty throughout his life. But was there a counterpart for you that made you think about the weight of carrying around one action that you regret forever and that you try eventually to compensate for?
Not so much that, but I think... when you talk to people who, the diaspora, people who live in exile, where their native country is being demolished. There's always this, at least for me, there always has been this undercurrent of guilt about my own good fortunes and my own life. And I have thought from time to time about people that I knew in Afghanistan who were poor, who worked as cooks and gardeners, and I wonder what has happened to them. I've thought about Hossein Khan, this man who I was friends with, who was a cook in my household, many times, and wonder, you know, if he's even alive or what has happened to him. And there's this always this kind of sense of guilt and unease, like an undercurrent. And so when I was writing this character of Amir, that was something that I was always there. His guilt, it was pervasive, and so it became kind of this theme in the book. But I think a lot of it stems just from the way that I view my own life.
Are there traditions from Afghanistan that you still keep?
Well, in my household, I think everything begins with language. So I speak Farsi to my children. My son, who's four, is completely bilingual. My daughter is learning both languages. I think it starts with that. But there are, you know, wedding traditions that, of course, that are kept in our community. I observe Ramadan. I'm not a stringent Muslim, but I do observe it almost in a cultural kind of way. And then at the end of Ramadan, there are 3 days of feasts where you go and visit family and relatives, and we invariably do that. So there are Afghan traditions that we try to keep, but inevitably it kind of becomes diluted by the ambient environment and the culture around us, which is so overpowering. So, you know, I want to preserve enough so that my children will have some knowledge, some appreciation of their background or where they came from, understanding that they can never register with them the way it did and does with me.
You mentioned the traditions of weddings. In your novel, The Kite Runner, the father spends $35,000, nearly the balance of his life savings, on his son's wedding ceremony. Did your father do that for your wedding?
Yeah, God bless him. He dug deep in his pockets and threw a wonderful wedding. We had over, I think, 600 people show up to the wedding. About 500 of them were invited. And so it was this big affair in Fremont, and my dad paid for it.
You know a lot of people.
Well, you know, Afghans are very social creatures. You know, and this goes back to the way of life in Afghanistan, where, you know, in the 60s and 70s, there wasn't much to do. There's a wonderful line from a friend of mine who's a writer, Tamim Ansari, who wrote in his book, West of Kabul, East of New York. He said, in the West, you have television. In Afghanistan, we had genealogy. And so people sat around, you know, and they talked about who's related to who, and this very complex network of how people are connected. And so those connections and those relations stay with you. And so when your oldest son is getting married, it seems almost unthinkable to omit people. So yeah, there was a lot of people.
So did you feel grateful or guilty that your father spent so much money on your wedding?
I felt grateful, and then I felt very guilty, so I paid him back.
Oh, did you really? After
yeah,
the book was
time.
Published or before that?
No, when I became a practicing physician, and he didn't want to take it back. He was very graceful about it, but I felt like I felt like he'd done enough for me already, so I paid him back.
My guest is Khaled Hosseini, author of the best-selling novel The Kite Runner. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Khaled Hosseini, author of the best-selling novel The Kite Runner, which is inspired by his own experiences growing up in Afghanistan before the Soviet invasion. What do you think of how America has handled it's part of the war in Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, I spoke to a lot of Afghans when I was in Kabul about the role of the U.S. and what was going on in Afghanistan. And by and large, there's still quite a bit of goodwill for the American presence in Afghanistan from the Afghans. The hope there, and what everybody wants to see, and what I want to see as well, is that the focus of the American effort there will shift a little bit from the military to the economic and to the actual rebuilding of the country. Not that that's not being done, but sometimes there's this feeling that that's almost a distant second, and that the focus there is really to root out the Al-Qaeda remnants and defeat the Taliban. So, you know, I think I speak for a lot of different Afghans, hope for more of a rebuilding effort from the Americans in Afghanistan.
Do you think democracy is taking root in Afghanistan?
You know, I think the idea of a kind of a secular Western idea of democracy in Afghanistan is a is not a reality, and I don't think it's realistic. That said, I think there's a chance for an Afghan version of a democracy where, you know, Afghanistan can kind of derive from its own traditions and its own culture to, you know, set up a system of government where people can participate and it's relatively open and accessible and fair. But to imagine a sort of a Western-style democracy in Afghanistan today or even in the near future, I think, is unfathomable.
Has the Kite Runner been translated into Farsi?
Well, I was recently notified that it was. I got an email from an Iranian woman in Tehran who somewhat apologetically said, we don't have copyright laws in Iran, but I just want to let you know I translated your book and a publisher has published your book. So if you want a copy, let me know and I'll send it to you. So it's available now in Farsi. It's available in Iran, and I'm sure that it will very quickly make its way into Afghanistan, where the book has been read, at least in Kabul, to some extent in English already. But I think in Farsi, it'll reach a larger number of people.
My guest is Khaled Hosseini, and he's the author of the bestseller, The Kite Runner. You know, you grew up in Kabul, and I grew up in Brooklyn. One of the cultural things we have in common is that we both loved The Magnificent Seven when we were growing up. And I assume you did anyways, because your main character does. So I assume he's speaking for you on that account.
Yeah.
And your character sees it 13 times and also learns the hard way that you're not supposed to reveal the ending of movies to friends in the United States. Friends who haven't seen the movie. And you say the opposite is true in Afghanistan, that people always want to know, do they find happiness at the ending? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember you go see a film and they say, well, is it a happy ending or a sad ending? Do they die at the end? And that's like the first thing they want to know. So you tell them, no, it has a happy ending. And people would go with some sense of, I guess, security to see the film. But I learned, as you say, kind of the hard way that there's a word for that in the States. It's called spoiling it. And so it's you're not supposed to do that.
So what did you love about The Magnificent Seven?
Oh, God. Yul Brynner, Steve McQueen, Charles Bronson. Seven guys against the whole gang. What's there not to like? It was mythical. I loved it.
So you loved an American Western when you were growing up. When you found out you were going to be moving to the western part of the United States, did you expect to find guys on horses there?
You know, up until the time when we moved to Paris, I actually did. And I thought there were really two kinds of Americans, cowboys and hippies. And so I was convinced that that's what I would find if I ever went to the States. This was in the 70s, and there was this influx of the hippie culture in Kabul.
Oh, sure.
There were opium houses and hashish everywhere, very cheap, and everybody was friendly. And so most of my contact with Westerners at that time was with hippies. And then the cowboys from the movies. Then I moved to France and I gradually realized that, not all Westerners are hippies and there really aren't that many cowboys. And, you know, judging by what I was seeing on television from the U.S. And so by the time I came here, I was 15 and sadly all those childhood ideas were gone.
Khaled Hosseini is the author of the best-selling novel The Kite Runner. The most talked about British literary phenomenon of the summer is a first novel by the British writer Chris Cleeve. Book critic Maureen Corrigan tells us why.
July 7th, 2005, the day of the London bus and underground bombings, was also the day that Chris Cleeve's debut novel Incendiary, which is about a major terrorist attack in London, was released in the UK. Depending upon which side of the Atlantic you stand, that morbid coincidence, as it's been called, was either a publicist's nightmare or a grotesque opportunity. In Britain, advertisements for the novel were pulled. Some had already been posted in the underground stations. In the U.S., the publicity campaign for the novel was intensified. Lest I sound holier than thou, I have to admit that a big reason why I, and presumably many other reviewers, have been attracted to this first novel is precisely because of its ugly timeliness. But here's another irony to add to all those clustering about Incendiary. One of the most newsworthy aspects of this novel, its grounding conceit really, is also its weakest feature. Incendiary is structured as an old-fashioned epistolary novel, specifically as one long and very improbable letter written by a young widow and mother to Osama bin Laden. This unnamed working-class woman lost her policeman husband and 4-year-old son when suicide bombers blew up a London soccer stadium. Our narrator was watching the match on TV as she was having vigorous extramarital sex with an upper-class toff whom she met at a pub. "Dear Osama," her novel-length letter begins, "they want you dead or alive so the terror will stop." Well, I wouldn't know about that. I mean, rock and roll didn't stop when Elvis died. It just got worse. This is not a promising opening. Nor is our narrator's declaration that she's writing to Osama because she wants to convert him away from terrorism through love, specifically by making him feel the grief-stricken love she has for her dead little boy, a compelling reason for us readers to stick with this confessional letter. Our narrator may believe in the logic of what she's doing, but by the time she's begun writing, she's become mentally unhinged. Every time our narrator directly addresses Osama, the credibility of Incendiary collapses. But if readers can just blot out the O word, there's a lot to appreciate here. Our narrator's voice is emotionally expressive, the crucial ending plot twist is truly disturbing, and Cleeve, like his countryman Martin Amis, possesses a gimlet eye which he trains on every manifestation of social posturing and cheap sentimentality. When she sees the explosion on TV, our narrator races to the burning stadium to try to find her husband and son. She's seriously injured, and when she comes to one morning in the hospital, she hears the radio announce that the death toll is up to 1,003, which is then followed by, what else, the airing of the inevitable just-written song by Sir Elton John called "England's Heart is Bleeding." Or take this satiric but not wholly unlikely touch of futuristic scene setting by Cleeve. As part of London's new defense measures, a host of barrage balloons tethered to thick cables are launched above the city. If airplanes try to attack its tall buildings, they'll be tangled up in the cables. Faces of the stadium victims have been painted on the balloons, and the whole effort is officially called the Shield of Hope. Here's our narrator's blunt description of the balloon-filled sky as she stares at it one summer afternoon. They hadn't chosen very nice people for the balloons around Hyde Park. The faces were mostly fat blokes who looked like they could tuck the pints away. You could imagine them pinching your bum at a New Year's Eve party, saying, "How about it, darling?" It was funny seeing those dead fat blokes 500 feet up in the air saving us from kamikazes. It might have been the first decent thing they'd done in their lives, most of them. As is commonly acknowledged, the Brits still get the issue of class better than we Americans do, and Cleave's novel is informed by comic as well as deadly serious observations about the consequences of the class divide. It's hard to say if all its strengths will save Incendiary from simply being the literary oddity of the moment. As our gravely depressed narrator is told by a callous acquaintance, the world wants to move on from tragedy and horror. The last irony to attach itself to this novel encrusted in ironies is that Incendiary may well end up being a victim of its own much-talked-about timing.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Incendiary, the debut novel by Chris Cleave. The bass player Keeter Betts died Saturday at the age of 77. One of the people he recorded with was Dinah Washington. He's featured on this 1955 recording.
If they ask me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface on how we met so the world would never forget. And the simple secret of the plot, it's just to tell you that I love you a lot. Then the world discovers, as my book ends, how to make two lovers a friends.
Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on producer and arranger Jack Nitzsche. This is Fresh Air. When you hold in your hands a CD with both Doris Day singing Move Over Darling and Marianne Faithfull singing Sister Morphine, it can only be an overview of the career of producer and arranger Jack Nitzsche. The CD is called The Jack Nitzsche Story, Hearing is Believing. Rock historian Ed Ward calls him the unsung hero of rock and roll.
Nitzsche was the man who was everywhere. The son of German immigrant parents who, yes, were related to the philosopher Nietzsche, he was born in Illinois in 1937 and found his way to Hollywood in 1955, determined to study music. That didn't last long. Soon he was working as a music copyist at Specialty Records for their new songwriter Sonny Bono. By 1961, he was getting a reputation as an arranger, capable of writing string parts and orchestral segments for pop songs. And this brought him to the attention of Phil Spector. Spector may have talked a lot about writing little symphonies for the kids, but he still needed someone to put the notes on paper. Nitzsche was his man.
See the way he walks down. street. That's the way he shuffles.
He's a Rebel was Nitsche's first arrangement for Spector and one of his simplest, but he'd formed a major partnership with an influential producer. He was also writing songs and arranging them for records, like this one by Jackie DeShannon.
I saw him today, I saw his face, it was a face I loved, and I knew I had to run away.
Spector's influence, the upfront percussion, the multi-tracked acoustic guitar, was obvious, and so is this version's superiority to the Dave Clark Fives, thanks to Nitsche's arranging skills. Still, he wanted to advertise a bit, so he pulled some strings and did a record for Frank Sinatra's new label, Reprise. It wasn't a big hit, but it made waves. The Lonely Surfer was hardly surf music, the six-string bass lead notwithstanding, but it was pretty sophisticated for rock and roll, and it got him work. Bobby Darin, Doris Day, Little Stevie Wonder, and of course Phil Spector made sure he was busy. In 1964, the Rolling Stones decided to do some recording at RCA Studios in Hollywood and appear in a film called The Tammy Show, of which Nitsche was musical director, and another major connection was made. He wound up playing keyboards on numerous Stones tracks, including Satisfaction, where he's just barely audible. Unsurprisingly, as rock and roll changed, Nitsche was able to change with it. After Phil Spector hung up his earphones in 1966, Nitsche kept his tradition alive. I have no idea who Gary Bonner was, but this record from 1967 shows a lot of risk-taking in its arrangement. So does this one.
stood on the edge of your feather, expecting to fly. Well, I laughed.
Nietzsche's relationship with Neil Young, whom he first produced on Expecting to Fly, would see him joining Young's band, Crazy Horse, playing on and producing many tracks, and eventually moving onto his ranch. Unfortunately, he also started living like a rock star during the 1970s, picking up some rock star bad habits. He continued to work at his usual feverish pace, moving into film soundtrack scoring after doing Nicholas Roeg's film Performance, starring Mick Jagger. He did over 20 during the 1980s. Nietzsche landed in rehab over and over, and in 1998 he had a stroke. 2 years later, he died from complications of an infection. Among those at his funeral were Nancy Sinatra, Sean Penn, and the Cramps, which is fitting for a man who is everywhere.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. He reviewed the Jack Nietzsche story, Hearing is Believing. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Mike and Scott. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Won't you welcome from Calumet City, Illinois, the show band of Joliet Jake and Elwood Blues, the Blues Brothers.
The film The Blues Brothers is 25 years old, and there's a new anniversary edition on DVD. On the next Fresh Air, Blues Brother Dan Aykroyd. Join us.